of WBAI, Help It Pay Its Bills. You can call 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. Or you can go to the WBAI website. That's WBAI.org and click Buddy. So you can become a buddy. That's a monthly sustainer. $15 a month, $10 a month, $25 a month. Or you could make a one-shot contribution to WBAI to help keep it alive. It's independent radio. Independent media is essential to the functioning of a democratic society. So go to WBAI.org or call 212-209-2950. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks.
WBAI New York at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Good morning. My name is Michael G. Haskins, your radio host and guide weekday mornings. I hope all of you are doing well. We're a commercial-free and listener-sponsored radio station. We need you, and to survive and to grow, we depend upon you. Please consider becoming a sustaining member or a first-time subscriber to this radio station by calling our pledge line right now at 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. 9 o'clock here in New York City. Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall will be back with us next Tuesday at 9 a.m. But right now we have an encore presentation of Talkback with Hugh Hamilton. Please stay tuned. And coming up at 10 o'clock, we'll be clearing the fog with Margaret Flowers.
Welcome now to this edition. We here at WBAI, a listener-sponsored commercial-free radio broadcasting at 99.5 FM. We are going to be resuscitating our collective interest in the history of the United States and in the history of the world. We're going to be putting a tremendous amount of emphasis on history, and I'm very happy that you're along for the ride. Here's the number to call, by the way. This is the number you call when you would like to make a tax-deductible contribution to WBAI, which we hope you will do in the course of the program this afternoon. Here is the number to call with your pledge of support. Beginning right now, 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. That's the number to call with your tax-deductible contribution to WBAI, listener-sponsored commercial-free radio. And we thank you very much in advance for your support. You can use your Visa, American Express, or MasterCard. You can honor your pledge with a personal check, money order. You can use the electronic funds transfer system, the installment plan. However you do this, we encourage you to make that call, 212-209-2950, because, of course, it is your support that helps us to keep the microphones live, the lights on here at the radio station. And without your support, none of this is possible. I want to begin today by sharing with you an excerpt from the all-too-brief life story of a fellow named Green Cottenham. On March 30th of 1908, Green Cottenham was arrested by the sheriff of Shelby County, Alabama, and charged with vagrancy. Cottenham had committed no real crime. Vagrancy, which is the offense of a person not being able to prove at any given moment that he or she is employed, was a new and flimsy concoction dredged up from legal obscurity at the end of the 19th century by the state legislatures of Alabama and other southern states. It was capriciously enforced by local sheriffs and constables, adjudicated by mayors and notaries public, recorded haphazardly or not at all in court records, and, most tellingly, in a time of massive unemployment among all Southern men, it was reserved almost exclusively for black men. Cottenham's offense was blackness. After 3 days behind bars, the 22-year-old Green Cottenham was found guilty in a swift appearance before the county judge and immediately sentenced to a 30-year term, a 30-day, I'm sorry, that's a 30-day term of hard labor. Unable to pay the array of fines assessed on every prisoner, fees to the sheriff, the deputy, additional fees to the court clerk and to the witnesses, Cottenham's sentence was extended to nearly a year of hard labor. The next day, Cottenham, the youngest of nine children born to former slaves in an adjoining county, was sold. Remember, we're talking here about 1908. Cottenham, the youngest of nine children born to former slaves in an adjoining county, was sold. Under a standing arrangement between the county and a vast subsidiary of the industrial titan of the North, U.S. Steel Corporation, the sheriff turned the young man over to the company for the duration of his sentence. And in return, the subsidiary, Tennessee Coal, Iron, and Railroad Company, gave the county $12 a month to pay off Cottenham's fine and fees. What the company's managers did with Cottenham and thousands of other black men they purchased from sheriffs across Alabama was entirely up to them. A few hours later, the company plunged Cottenham into the darkness of a mine called Slope Number 12. One shaft in a vast subterranean labyrinth on the edge of Birmingham known as the Pratt Mines. There he was chained inside a long wooden barrack at night and required to spend nearly every waking hour digging and loading coal. His required daily task was to remove 8 tons of coal from the mine. Cottenham was subject to the whip for failure to dig the requisite amount, at risk of physical torture for disobedience and vulnerable to the sexual predations of other miners, many of whom already had passed years or decades in their own Athonian confinement. The lightless catacombs of black rock, packed with hundreds of desperate men, slick with sweat and coated in pulverized coal, must have exceeded any vision of hell a boy born in the countryside of Alabama, even a child of slaves, could ever have imagined. Waves of disease ripped through the population. In the month before Cottenham arrived at the prison mine, pneumonia and tuberculosis sickened dozens. Within his first 4 weeks, 6 others had died. Before the year was over, almost 60 men forced into Slope 12 were dead of disease, accidents, or homicide. Most of the broken bodies, along with hundreds of others before and after, were dumped into shallow graves scattered among the refuse of the mine. Others were incinerated in nearby ovens used to blast millions of tons of coal brought to the surface into coke, the carbon-rich fuel essential to U.S. Steel's production of iron. 45 years after President Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation freeing American slaves, Green Cottonham and more than 1,000 other black men toiled under the lash at Slope 12. Imprisoned in what was then the most advanced city of the South, guarded by whipping bosses employed by the most iconic example of the modern corporation emerging in the Gilded North, they were slaves in all but name. Now, that passage is taken from Douglas Blackman's introduction to his 2009 Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Slavery by Another Name, The Reenslavement of Black Americans from the Civil War to World War II. The book has since been adapted into a feature-length documentary film narrated by Lawrence Fishburne. And I am very pleased to say that we are going to send you that documentary film on DVD as a thank you gift when you make a pledge of support to WBAI at the $100 level. Now, you can make a pledge at whatever level is comfortable and convenient for you. 10, 20, 35, 50, 75, 100, 500, 1,000, whatever works for you. This is the way it works, you see. You make a pledge of support. It's a tax-deductible contribution to your listener-sponsored radio station at a level that's comfortable and convenient for you. And that is what helps us to keep the lights on and the microphones live on this diadem in the middle of the FM dial. So we ask you then to call this number. It's 212-209-2950. You can use your Visa, American Express, or MasterCard. You can honor your pledge with a personal check or money order. You can use the electronic funds transfer system or the installment plan. But we ask you right now to go to the phones to make that pledge, to call WBAI 212-209-2950. It is your support that makes it possible, because we are not beholden to any of the corporate or commercial advertisers or underwriters. We do not accept their money. And we do not accept their money precisely because we want to be able to retain the editorial independence and integrity for which the Pacifica Foundation and WBAI have been renowned. This radio station, WBAI, has been able to stand tall, has been able to hold its head high among all media. Why? Because we do not have to make the kinds of deals or make the kinds of compromises, and we do not have to sacrifice the standards and the integrity that so many in the corporate or so-called mainstream media have to do in order to appease their advertisers and the people who pay their bills. The people who pay the bills here are you. You pay the bills here at WBAI, and therefore you empower us to do what we do best, which is to call it as we see it, to tell it as we know it. Anybody can tell you what the news is. You come here to understand what it means and why it matters. That is what we do. And during the course of these membership or fundraising drives, we present these what I call long-form features, and in which we are able to concentrate on a particular issue or a particular time period. I'm focusing on history, because so much of that history is quite frankly unknown. In fact, Douglas Blackman, in his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Slavery by Another Name, was able to unearth a history that until his reporting had been pretty much had been hidden, sequestered, shuttered from any public view. And all of the professional historians, this guy, Douglas Blackman, is a journalist. And this book arose out of a journalistic piece that he did for the Wall Street Journal, which was and continues to be the number one conservative newspaper in the country. It arose out of a lengthy piece, an investigation that he did for the Wall Street Journal. And his findings were so stunning that he was able to put them together in a book, a 400 and what is this? This is a 468-page book that was subsequently adapted into this full-length 90-minute documentary film. And we're going to share excerpts from this documentary with you, but we also would like you to call us at 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. To underscore or to demonstrate your your appreciation and support for what we do and make a pledge of support, a tax-deductible contribution to WBAI. And we'd love for you to have this documentary in your own hands. And we will send that documentary to you as a thank you gift. Then you send, make a pledge of support to WBAI at the $100 level. Call us at 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. So remember, your $100 tax deductible contribution gets you this documentary, Slavery by Another Name. Slavery by Another Name challenges one of our country's most cherished assumptions, and that is the belief that slavery ended with Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation in 1863. And part of the narrative that we are hearing, that there is a subtext, since you guys have been free, so I mean, deal with it already, get over it. It's been 150 years, that's a long time. Of course it's a long time. However, as Douglas Blackman explains in his book, Slavery by Another Name, his book challenges one of the most cherished assumptions in this country, and that is the mistaken belief that slavery ended with Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation in 1863. The frank answer to that is no, it did not. And this documentary recounts how, in the years following the Civil War, and remember, the Civil War continued until 1865, but and this documentary recounts how, in the years following the Civil War, insidious new forms of forced labor emerged in the American South, keeping hundreds of thousands of African Americans in bondage, trapping them in a brutal system that would persist until the onset of World War II. It is, as I mentioned earlier, based on Douglas Blackman's research and his book Slavery by Another Name. It spans a period of 8 decades, from 1865 to 1945, revealing the interlocking forces in both the South and the North that enabled this neo-slavery to begin and persist. Using archival photographs and dramatic reenactments filmed on location in Alabama and Georgia, this documentary tells the forgotten stories of both victims and perpetrators of neo-slavery and includes interviews with their descendants living today. The program also features interviews with Douglas Blackman himself and with leading scholars of the period. Here's how the New York Times describes Blackman's work. Quote, in Slavery by Another Name, Douglas A. Blackman eviscerates one of our school children's most basic assumptions, that slavery in America ended with the Civil War. Mr. Blackman unearths shocking evidence that the practice persisted well into the 20th century, and he is not simply referring to the virtual bondage of black sharecroppers unable to extricate themselves economically from farming. He describes free men and women forced into industrial servitude, bound by chains, faced with subhuman living conditions, and subject to physical torture. That plight was horrific, but until 1951, it was not outside the law. You heard me correctly. Quoting from Janet Maslin's review in the New York Times, until 1951, none of what I mentioned to you was outside the law. And 1951 is well within the lifetime of many who are listening to this program right now. All it took was anything remotely resembling a crime. Bastardy, gambling, changing employers without permission, false pretense, selling cotton after sunset. These were all grounds for arrest in rural Alabama by 1890. And as Mr. Blackman explains in describing incident after incident, an arrest could mean a steep fine, and if the accused could not pay this debt, then he or she might be imprisoned. Alabama was among the southern states that profitably leased convicts to private businesses. And as Blackman illustrates, arrest rates and the labor needs of local businesses could conveniently be made to dovetail. So here's, in a nutshell, here's how the system worked. after the Civil War. Now you have all these black people, 4 million formerly enslaved people, who are now at least free on paper. You have in the few years following that, following the 13th Amendment in 1865, you have and following the so-called slave amendments, you have the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments being ratified in short order thereafter, a couple of years thereafter, so that at least on paper, these are people who at least under the 14th Amendment are protected, are supposed to enjoy the equal protection of the law. They're all born here for the most part, so they're American citizens under the terms of the 14th Amendment. The 13th Amendment abolished slavery, except of course as punishment for a crime, which is something that Blackmun addresses very early in this documentary. With the passage of with the ratification of the 15th Amendment, then black males were given the right to vote. So at least on paper, these people are now free. Well, how does the South deal with that? As Blackmun explains in this book, the emancipation of slaves left Southern plantations not just financially, but intellectually bereft, because the slaves' knowledge and experience were indispensable. Think about that for a moment. You see, we often have this idea that all of these enslaved people are there as manual labor, which they are, and that they're forced to do this menial work for no pay, which they are, that they're tortured and beaten and abused at will by their white owners, and by any person who is white, because whiteness is a privileged condition in this country, and all of that is true. But what happens when all of these people are now liberated, at least in theory, from the bondage, from this condition of enslavement? What happens to the places where they used to work? Well, their collective memory and expertise now being removed from the plantation means that the plantation is not just financially but intellectually bereft, because as the New York Times points out in its review of Douglas Blackmun's work, the slaves' knowledge and experience could be indispensable. How the rise of industry reshaped the South, and how a new generation of African Americans who had not known slavery found themselves threatened by it, becomes the rest of this story. So how does the South respond to that? Well, it responds by, first of all, creating something called the Black Codes. This is a series of laws that are passed in these southern states, which are intended specifically to criminalize almost any kind of behavior on the part of blacks. Now, does this sound familiar to you? Remember, when we talk about stop and frisk, and we talk about the disproportionate representation of African Americans in the incarcerated population of the United States in the 21st century, one of the points often made by those of us who understand how this system works and who have been working to focus attention on the unfairness, the underlying unfairness of the system, one of the things we've been emphasizing is this, that you will find criminal behavior depending on A, how you define crime, and B, where it is that you do the policing in search of that crime. It's as simple as that. So what happened then was that even as former slaves fought to assert their independence and gain economic autonomy during the earliest years of Reconstruction, white landowners acted to control the labor force through a system similar to the one that had existed during slavery. And to that end, in late 1865, Mississippi and South Carolina, remember, I keep asking, what's the matter with South Carolina? Do you know? But in late 1865, Mississippi and South Carolina enacted the first of these black codes. Mississippi's law, for example, required blacks to have written evidence of employment for the coming year each January. If they left before the end of the contract, they would be forced to forfeit earlier wages and were subject to arrest. In South Carolina, a law prohibited blacks from holding any occupation other than farmer or servant unless they paid an annual tax of $10 to $100. Now, this is 1865, $10 to $100. This provision, of course, hit free blacks already living in Charleston and former slave artisans especially hard. In both states, blacks were given heavy penalties for for vagrancy, which is the same offense on which Green Cottenham was rounded up and thrown into enslavement in this coal mine, including forced plantation labor in some cases. So they created these artificial crimes. Think now, you think about this. These people are now emancipated on paper. Of course, for most of them do not have, they don't own anything. They barely own the few clothes on their backs. So they're not, they still have to figure out a way to make a living. So what do the plantation owners do? They force these people who, for the most part, are functionally illiterate or absolutely illiterate, not because they're not smart, but because they have been denied access to education as a matter of law. It was illegal. In fact, I'll tell you this. In some southern states, the penalty for being caught teaching a black person to read was worse than the penalty for enabling the escape of an enslaved person. You see, it was taken that seriously. So now you have these people there. What do the plantation owners do? They create these laws that now and these conditions. So people have to sign contracts that they can't read. And if you don't have a contract that shows that you are literally bound to service somewhere, usually on the plantation in which you had previously been enslaved, or some condition that is very similar to it, then you were subject to arrest for vagrancy. So this now constrained you to go to the very people from whom you're supposedly liberated to ask them for a job, and to now be placed in a condition where they pretty much are in complete control of every aspect of your life. So, all that, and what happens when you're arrested? Well, you have this other situation occurring where the manufacturing, the factories and the coal mines and the railroads and everybody who has any kind, and the plantations and so on, they of course need labor. So what do they do? If you're coming up to the cotton season and the plantation will need so many people to pick the cotton, what you do now is you simply begin to enforce some of these ridiculous laws, the so-called black codes, which leads now to a rounding up of hundreds, whatever is the total workforce you'll need. If you need 500 people, you just simply round up 500 people, black people, and charge them with vagrancy or whatever, or speaking loudly in the presence of a white woman. That's another one. That's one of my favorites. You'll hear in the course of this documentary, Dr. Khalil Gibran Muhammad, who is now the director of the Schomburg Center, and who at the time of the making of the documentary was a professor of history at Indiana University. He's among the voices you'll hear. He's among the scholars featured in this documentary. So you'll hear about the so-called pig laws and so many others. Like, it is illegal for a black person to walk beside a railroad, or illegal for a black person to sell the produce from his farm after dark. It's no problem finding 500 people, rounding them up. And of course, these people they cannot afford to pay the fines, because now fines are assessed. They now have to pay fines that are now due to the judge, to the prosecutor, to the witnesses. They can't afford to pay these fines, and so first of all, they are railroaded through these kamikaze courts where they're found guilty, and they're fined an amount of money that they could not possibly produce, and so their debt is now bought. What happens now is some company, the plantation, steps in and they say, well, look, we will pay off this person's fine, and that person is now sold into labor to the plantation owner, where he now has to work off that debt. That is known as debt peonage, which was supposedly illegal in the United States. Then you also have that now leading to this convict leasing system, all of which is covered in this documentary. So I've been talking for a while, and I did this because, well, as you know, I like to frame the conversation. I like to frame the topic, and we're fast approaching the bottom of the hour. The number to call is 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. The documentary is called Slavery by Another Name. It is based, it is an adaptation, a documentary adaptation of Douglas Blackman's Pulitzer Prize winning book of the same name, Slavery by Another Name, The Re-Enslavement of Black Americans from the Civil War to World War II. The documentary is narrated by Lawrence Fishburne. It is directed by Sam Pollard and produced by Catherine Allen and Douglas Blackman. And we're gonna feature now an excerpt from the beginning of that documentary. I would like to urge you to call while the presentation is in progress. It is so important that you do, because we do need to make sure that we keep meeting our goals. Okay, we're operating here on the honor system. So in the next 10 minutes, I'm looking for 30 calls in the next 10 to 12 minutes. 30 calls in the next 10 to 12 minutes with your pledge at whatever level is convenient for you. And I know that you can call that number, and you can also listen to the documentary. You can do both of those. I know you can. You've done it so many times before, I ask you to do it again. The number again is 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. This is WBAI New York. Hear now an excerpt from Slavery by Another Name.
Mr. President, I have a brother about 14 years old. A man hired him from me and I heard of him no more. He went and sold him to McGree, and they's been working him in prison for 12 months. I asked him to let me have him, but he won't let him go.
For a period of nearly 80 years, between the Civil War and World War II, black Southerners were no longer slaves, but they were not yet free. In one of the most shameful and little-known chapters of American history, generations of black Southerners were forced to labor against their will.
From almost the first moment, white Southerners were responding to try to put African Americans back into a position as close to slavery as they possibly could.
The Old South and what was quickly becoming the New South could not proceed without the work of African Americans.
But if you had something for free in the past, you don't necessarily want to pay for it now.
It was a straight, simple, exploitative system. There was only power, there was only force, and there was only brutality.
What happened in that period of time was so much more terrible than anything most Americans recognize or understand today. The depth of poverty, the inability of African Americans to access any of the mechanisms of wealth achievement and growth, they're all rooted in this terroristic kind of regime that existed in so many places.
Their ability to have what we call the American dream, that is what has been stolen from black folks all through the South. And that legacy has to be understood so that people will be able to speak to it and give our ancestors voice.
My name is Sharon Malone, and my family is originally from Wilcox County, Alabama. My father was born in 1893. As a child, I never knew why Dad didn't share many of the stories growing up in the rural South. There was so little that I actually knew about, you know, the generations beyond my parents. And I realized, I said, why don't I know these stories, and why don't I know who those people are? African Americans are innately wired to want to know who we are. It's almost like being an adopted child. We have no understanding of not only what we have endured, but what we have survived.
Freedom. Freedom.
Freedom must have felt glorious to those who'd never known it. With the end of the Civil War and the passage of the 13th Amendment, 4 million former slaves could embark on new lives with no one in charge but themselves.
And go home to my Lord and be free.
And what they desired more than anything was independence. They wanted independence from white owners. They wanted their own churches. They wanted their own schools. They wanted freedom to move.
African Americans after emancipation are looking at the potential not only to enjoy and receive freedom, but to live it. They're deeply committed to reaffirming marriage vows. They're deeply committed to reconstituting families.
Ezekiel Archie, born into slavery, was 6 when freedom came. His mother moved the family, Zeke, his 2 brothers and a sister, from Georgia to Alabama, away from the old plantation and toward a new future.
African Americans were willing to work very hard and exploit themselves in the same way that immigrants who have come to this country have exploited themselves and their families with long work days. They were willing to do that, but they wanted to own their own land. They wanted to control those hours. They wanted to be the ones to decide.
John Davis was born a dozen years after the war. He grew up in freedom, working hard on an Alabama farm rented by his parents.
There was a tremendous motivation and desire to integrate into American life.
Green Cottonham, born in 1885. Was also the son of an Alabama farmer. He came of age in a nation that was increasingly urban, industrial, and modern.
This is a photo of George Cottingham. He's my great-grandfather. He was actually Green Cottingham's first cousin. How hopeful my Cottingham ancestors must have been about bright futures for their family. These were hard-working, honest people.
But freedom had come at a tremendous cost. The war devastated the Southern economy, which had supported one of the wealthiest aristocracies in the world.
The cotton economy was in complete shambles. The fields had been burned, the cotton gins had been destroyed. Equipment that was necessary for the production of cotton didn't exist anymore. But also the primary engine of the economy, of the cotton economy, that being the labor of slaves, was lost.
In the 5 major cotton states of the Deep South, nearly half of all capital, nearly half of all investment was in human beings. So when those human beings were confiscated, when the investment was transferred, in essence, from slaveholders to the people themselves, that meant a huge loss of capital to Southern slaveholders, to the people who controlled the economy of the South.
A tiny slaveholding elite had owned the majority of the region's 4 million slaves. Among them was Lucinda Comer, a widow. After the war, she and her sons oversaw the family's enterprises in cotton, lumber, and corn.
I'm the great-great-granddaughter of B.B. Comer, who was the governor of Alabama, and the great-great-niece of J.W. Comer. The things that I heard about the Comer men, especially B.B. Comer, were about their entrepreneurial spirit and being self-made men. There was never a fool or a coward, it was said, in the Comer family.
Emancipation turned the former slaveholding world upside down.
The simple reality of people that they had once owned now were entitled to the same fruits of their labor, the same ability to look a white person in the eye, a man or a woman, and to demand equal respect, to be called by one's first and last names, challenged everything to the bitter core of white people's souls.
You have a group of people who are accustomed to have people serve them. Now, suddenly, these people are free. They own guns. You'd be as wary as hell. Because what you're worried is that people are going to take revenge. You also are worried that people aren't going to do any work anymore.
Most of the South's 8 million whites had not owned slaves. Poverty was widespread, and about a third of whites were illiterate.
Those individuals see blacks moving around, trying to get land, trying to improve themselves as competitors. They see a zero-sum game in which they're going to lose the more that blacks gain.
These whites aligned with leaders of the former Confederacy, aided by President Andrew Johnson, Lincoln's successor. They formed vigilante groups to attack and intimidate blacks. The violence grew widespread. In the spring of 1866, Congress intervened. Over the objections of the president, it launched an era known as Radical Reconstruction.
At the beginning of Reconstruction, there was a tremendous federal will to both bring the South into submission, but also to protect African-American civil rights.
Passed in 1866, the 14th Amendment recognized the citizenship of all freed people. In 1870, the 15th Amendment was passed, which upheld the right of black men to vote.
Reconstruction was an attempt to create a country in which it would be possible to have a biracial and equal citizenship.
Reconstruction gave African Americans, for the first time across the South, the opportunity to serve on juries, to be witnesses in trial, to serve as judges. It also made possible an entire generation of black politicians across the South, almost as many as 1,500 serving through the end of the 19th century.
Reconstruction governments in many parts of the South succeeded in passing new social legislation, creating the South's first free public schools. But white resistance to biracial government in the South intensified, and national political support began to wane. By 1874, voters had shifted the balance of power in Congress, allowing for the South's return to local control.
There is no sustained federal presence in the South really after 1874. What they come away with is that a sense that this is a really violent situation and that there's not much we can do about it. And there's not much perhaps we even should do about it.
African Americans seeking freedom could count on less and less help from the federal government, less and less help from sympathetic Northerners, and they could count on more and more and more animosity and attack from Southern whites.
I grew up in a black part of Mississippi, and I went to schools that were 60, 75% black all through my childhood. That was in the 1970s. What I learned about the Emancipation Proclamation was the most simplistic version of it, that that it brought an end to slavery. I also was taught, as most Americans were in some way, that the end of slavery unleashed this population of people who were ill-equipped for freedom. And that was all offered up in some respect as an explanation for the repressive things that were then done to African Americans, even the repressive things that I knew about. What I came to realize was that that fundamentally didn't happen.
With the end of Reconstruction, the nature of both crime and punishment in the South changed dramatically. In state after state and county after county, new laws targeted African Americans and effectively criminalized black life.
It was a crime in the South for a farm worker to walk beside a railroad. It was a crime in the South to speak loudly in the company of white women. It was a crime to sell the products of your farm after dark.
Anything from spitting or drinking or being found to be drunk in public or loitering in public spaces could result in confinement. So there was an over-exaggeration of African-American criminality during this time period. It's not to absolve all prisoners from having committed crimes, but there were many trumped-up charges.
One of the most infamous set of laws to come out of this period were the pig laws, passed in Mississippi, Georgia, Florida, Alabama, enhancing penalties for what had been previously misdemeanor offenses to now felony offenses.
In Mississippi, theft of a pig worth as little as a dollar could mean 5 years in prison. In Tennessee, hard labor might result from stealing an 8-cent fence rail.
But the most powerful, the most damaging of all of these laws were the vagrancy statutes. In every southern state, you became a criminal if you could not prove at any given moment that you were employed.
Under slavery, most black crime was punished by slaveholders, leaving the courts to discipline whites. Now, only about 10% of those arrested were white.
Now, what does this mean? Does this mean that white people are not committing crimes in the South? We know that's not true.
Southern states had a history of placing prisoners with industries that would bear the cost of guarding and housing them in exchange for their labor. Now states also began to charge fees, renting prisoners to companies by the month. The highest rates were for the strongest workers and longest sentences.
When you go to the 13th Amendment, one of the fascinating things about the text of that amendment is that it says that slavery is abolished, except in the case of a punishment for a crime. And within that wiggle room, what you see in it is that there's still the possibility of extending slavery, as it were, by another name.
Well, it's early in the morning, baby, when I rise, well,
the system was known as convict leasing.
When I rise, well, it's early in the morning.
It took time for the system of convict leasing to develop. It took time for the state to realize that prisoners, believe it or not, could be a source of profit. Once that revenue starts coming in, they're pleasantly surprised. This is new revenue we never had before.
The state of Alabama earned $14,000 in its first year of convict leasing, 1874. By 1890, revenue was $164,000, roughly $4.1 million today. By then, states throughout the South and hundreds of counties and cities were engaged in some form of leasing convicts to private industry.
And it gave tremendous discretionary power for the private owner, either a landowner or a corporation or a coal mine, could be any business concern, to do what they wanted with that African American.
We as convicts, it's something like a man drowning. We have been convicted of felonies. And because of that, we have lost every friend on earth.
In 1884, a series of remarkable letters was sent from the Pratt coal mines to Alabama's new inspector of prisons. Their author was Ezekiel Archie, now a 25-year-old convict.
That's 212-209-2950. You were just listening there to an opening excerpt from the documentary film Slavery by Another Name, The Re-Enslavement of Black Americans from the Civil War to World War II. It is based on Douglas Blackman's Pulitzer Prize winning book of the same name, and it is available as a thank you gift to you with your pledge at the $100 level to listener-sponsored commercial-free WBAI New York. Now, when you call that number, you can use your Visa, American Express, or MasterCard. You can honor your pledge with a personal check or money order. You can use the electronic funds transfer system or the installment plan. As you know, here on TalkBack, we take this very seriously. We take our responsibility very seriously to generate the resources that are necessary to sustain this diadem in the middle of the FM dial, this unique institution, this WBAI. And we're asking you now to underscore, to reaffirm your commitment to our ability to continue to bring you the kind of independent programming that has distinguished WBAI for all these years. 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. And I'm very pleased to welcome into the studio, we're working together for the first time, our colleague from the Left Coast, Christine Blasdale. A pleasure to work with you, Christine Blasdale.
Thank you. So I'm very happy to be here. I've been welcomed by everyone here at WBAI. Wonderful, warm welcome. And I'm so very happy that we can join forces, so to speak, to keep this amazing institution, WBAI, healthy. And that's what we really need to do. The support of listeners like you folks who are listening right now and who have been listening for so very long, it's so critical right now, because what we see is cutbacks happening with the corporation, the CPB money, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the attacks on public radio, unlike any other time. And this is really something that is worth standing up for and pledging your support, because this is your community radio station. WBAI takes no commercial funding, no underwriting, and we're not brought to you by Boeing or a pharmaceutical company or any type of corporation that is going to take away your rights. And in fact, we are one of the institutions that are here to help protect those rights, whatever rights we have left, so to speak. But we are here on your behalf. So we, I'm imploring you to give us a call and support this amazing radio station. These people, everyone that I have worked with, have worked so very hard to bring you the very best in public affairs and health and spirituality. And it is well worth your dollars. And we're asking for your support this hour for a particular thank you gift that we would like to send you with our love and appreciation. It is available to you, Slavery by Another Name, The Re-Enslavement of Black Americans from the Civil War to World War II, for a $100 contribution to WBAI. You can pledge online at WBAI.org. Click on the Fund Drive banner, mm-hmm, that's yes, listed there. And you can see all of our thank you gifts. If you want to do some shopping, shopping, that would be wonderful. Don't be limited to just this particular. I know we're moved by the material here, but maybe you see something else or you've heard a thank you gift that you were really interested in. Well, do some shopping today and know that your money is going to go to an incredible institution and to continue to bring you these voices. You don't hear these voices. You don't hear these stories. You don't hear the analysis that you do like at this radio station and for programs like the one that Hugh has done, and it's well worth your dollars, and it's well worth supporting and maintaining, because we want future generations to hear these words and these stories that are so very important and relevant today. The number to call to support this and to support the hard work of all these amazing people in front of the microphone, behind the microphone, in the hallways,
it's 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950.
And I also want you to know, don't be limited also by the $100 contribution. If you have the ability to pledge more than that, if you'd like to get a few copies of this to hand out to colleges and to high schools and let generations, younger generations know their history, know what has happened before, but also what we are currently facing right now. Because, you know, economic slavery is, you know, just as debilitating and life-threatening and spirit-crushing as physical slavery, as we all know. And that is so very important to break through and to give young people some hope and to give them an idea of what has happened before and what we need to do now so that we can give them a much better future. The number to call to support this amazing, amazing institution and Pacifica, you know, it's started by a pacifist. Mm-hmm. And in this world today with war and greed and bankers really just plundering the treasury and all of this, we do need to stand up for justice and we do need to stand up for truth. And I think this is a way you can do it by, you know, we're not asking you to come down to the station. We're not asking you to do anything but call and support with your $100 contribution. That would be great. But if you have the wherewithal and you can pledge more, please do. We would love to see a $1,000 contribution or a $5,000 contribution coming in. But we know that if you can afford only the $100 and you can put on your credit card and do a payment plan, that is just as powerful as a $1,000 pledge. So please give us a call.
212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950.
Indeed, and thank you so much, Christine Blasdale, visiting here and spending so much time with us. It's really wonderful that the Pacifica Network is coming together in this way.
And sharing
some of our human capital in this way. This is how the economists refer to people as human capital, and it's really wonderful of you to come down here and also to bring this your new insights and your enthusiasm to this process of raising funds for the radio station. It is probably not the ideal way to do what we do, but it is certainly the way that has enabled us to retain our editorial independence and integrity. Of course, with us, Michael G. Haskins, our audio engineer and director of Incidental Music.
Thank you so much, Hugh, and I certainly echo by welcoming Christine. Happy to have her here. Supporting WBAI, that's what we're doing here, and we're asking you to support the radio station as well by making a call, a simple call, 212-209-2950. It's a tax-deductible contribution, and you can pledge using Visa card, MasterCard, or American Express. We have today these thank you gifts. This thank you gift, Slavery by Another Name. It's a $100 contribution. Make your calls now. We have some people at the call center waiting to take your calls, and we want to move through this. We want to go back to more material. Of course, we always want to play more material when we have these long, these extended extended fundraising periods, we like to play as much material as we can to give you a sense and a flavor of what you're going to get, what this thank you gift is going to be. But yes, it is just a thank you gift. The thing that is most important for all of us to remember is that the radio station itself, that is what is important. The thank you gift is a wonderful thing. Having slavery by another name to share with family members, to share with community groups, to share with unions. And by the way, unions and community groups, we hope that you will call as well, because we do so much around those issues. 212-209-2950. Visa card, MasterCard, American Express. Call 212-209-2950. We need to hear from you right now. The most important thing, however, is the radio station. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, without commercial interruption or interference. 212-209-2950. And it's because of you. And we thank you so very, very much. So once again, Slavery by Another Name, a $100 contribution. And as Christine said, and as I often say, you can pledge at any amount, whatever is comfortable for you. Certainly, if you want to pledge at the entry level amount, you can do that. But if you can pledge a little bit more, if you can pledge that $500 or $1,000 for that matching fund, please do so now. We have people standing by ready to take your calls at 212-209-2950.
Indeed, thank you very much, Michael G. Haskins. Please continue to call 212-209-2950.
99.5 FM, WBAI, New York.
Join us on Tuesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. for the Independent News Hour, the weekly radio show of The Independent, New York City's radical newspaper. Each week, we speak with the activists, organizers, and social movement thought leaders who are fighting for a more just and equitable New York. That's the Independent News Hour, Tuesdays, 5 to 6 p.m., only here on WBAI 99.5 FM.